Nothing is more shameful than attacking sleeping children. That's how the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon reacted to news that a UN school being used as a shelter in Gaza was shelled yesterday, killing 16 people. Over 1,300 people have been killed so far in the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. 56 Israeli soldiers have also been killed. 200,000 people are taking refuge in UN shelters across Gaza. Paul Mason of Channel 4 News has been to the shelter that was attacked in Jabalia.
I was there about 3 hours after the attack, and just to describe it, it's a school, ordinary school, you know, two stories of classrooms at one end, one story of low kind of shed-like classrooms at the other end, a playground in the middle, toilets, that's it. You know, okay, now imagine that. Imagine a primary school in Ireland with 3,000 people living in it. So that's the first issue. What seems to have happened, according to witnesses, and I stress I have talked to quite a few witnesses, so it's on the internet, whenever you say what's happened, a lot of people say, you don't know. Okay, so I kind of think I do. There is an explosion goes off outside. They wake up and they're all told to go into the concrete two-story building at the north end of the school. More shelling goes off, and then it goes quiet, and they come out, and they realise that some people ran to one of the low blocks, which is just cinder, and something's hit it, and then there are bodies all and body parts all over the place, and indeed parts of a lot of animals, because they take their animals in as well. So that's what happened, and when we looked forensically at what hit it, we found, originally people said four, but there's three impacts, one on the north block, one on the south block, and one just outside where the animals are. Now, I'm not any kind of professional military analyst, but I do know that when artillery fire at things, they tend to spread, it tends to spread around the central point, and the central point is the flagpole right in the middle of the schoolyard. So it's very hard, given we're talking about a high-tech army, the Israeli army, and not some kind of shambolic semi-professional group, it's very hard not to conclude what they were aiming at was the school.
What of the credibility of the Israeli response saying we were possibly targeting something nearby or we probably didn't intend to hit the school, or it may not have been us at all?
Yeah, it was them. I mean, it was them. Everybody here knows what a rocket looks like when it lands. And more experienced journalists than I, are still debating about what happened the other day with those children in the park that the Israelis say were hit by one of Hamas's rockets. But what Hamas's rockets don't look like what happened to this school. So I'm pretty certain. You can't be 100% certain. I'm pretty certain these shells are Israeli, and the Israelis themselves said we were firing at a target nearby. Somebody had let off a mortar. Okay. I mean, this area is like a 19th century slum. It started as it's an old town, but there's a big refugee camp nearby. And over the years, over the 50-odd, 60-odd years they've been there, they built cinder block houses all around, very higgly-piggly. And the school is one of the most sort of regular structures in it, but all around it are narrow streets and lanes and alleyways. So, if you're going to fire, the shell fragment that I've got suggests that what it is an artillery shell. So this is something that comes up, if you stand it up and put your hand on the tip of it, it'll come up to sort of around about where your chest is. That's how big it is and how wide it is. It's like a big pipe. So you fire that full of explosives three times at something in a town of cinder blocks where 64% of the people in it are going to be under 16 anyway, because that's the demographic mix of Gaza. You're going to want a good idea that you're not going to kill civilians. I think firing something like that into a place like that, you're almost certain to kill civilians.
But what of the United States offering ammunition to Israel on the same day as its army attacks a UN shelter to which it had told civilians to go?
Well, this is what is meant by unshakable support for Israel. I mean, I think, it's for people in the United States and Britain and the other countries who support Israel to have that argument out. I think the argument will always be from mainstream politicians, we have to keep demonstrating our support for Israel, because that gives us the right to criticise and to negotiate, basically to pressure them in the back channels. But it demonstrates the issue, and a lot of people on the streets here. You know, I saw a guy yesterday, and his son had just died, and I said to him, I wanted to interview him. I said, look, started by saying I'm sorry, and he said, you know, don't tell me you're sorry. He said, you're from Britain, go back home, and just tell them to stop supporting Israel.
Paul Mason of Channel 4 News speaking to me just before we came on air.
Argentina has defaulted on its debt for the second time in 13 years. Attempts to broker a deal last night between Argentina and creditors demanding payment broke down. The last time Argentina couldn't pay its debts, there were dozens killed in riots on the streets when bank accounts were frozen. Paul Byrne is a reporter with the Associated Press in Buenos Aires and is on the line now. Paul, the amount of money involved here is pretty small. It's $1.3 billion, relatively small. Outline what happened.
Yeah, it's an incredibly complicated situation from the point of view is that there's a huge amount of legal technicalities involved. You know, even though it's been called a default, there's many different names being thrown around here locally. Standard & Poor's are calling it a selective default. In Argentina, they're calling it a vulture default. Primarily from the point of view is that Argentina had the money to begin to pay off these restructured bonds, $13 billion of restructured bonds that Argentina has to begin to pay off. And last night at 1 a.m. local time, it was due to make a payment of $539 million of the first installment of interest. But because of the situation that Argentina has owing a whole raft of different types of restructured bondholders and the varying degrees of acceptance by these different bondholders to negotiate different levels of payment. Basically, 90% of the bondholders that Argentina owes are willing to accept like 70% decrease on the full amount.
So is it fair to say then, Paul, that if this amount, if this $1.3 billion had been paid back in full, that everybody else, the 90% who owned the bulk of the debt, would have demanded different terms and would have wanted more money?
That's exactly the point of view of the Argentine government. Within the payment, there's various different clauses. The RUFO clause, which means rights under future offerings. So it means that the others that had accepted negotiated agreements by the law of the United States, because this was being tried in the U.S., it would have meant that they would not have been able to receive that. They would have had to receive the full amount, which for Argentina would have meant $13 billion, which is approximately 80% more than what they had negotiated.
And
so
Paul,
that's pretty much the situation.
Okay, and Paul, people will remember, and I mentioned it at the beginning, that in 2001 there were riots on the streets, people died, bank accounts were frozen. What will be the impact, do you think, of what happened last night?
Well, it is striking, because what happened in 2001 is described as an earthquake here in Argentina. It had such a strong impact. I can speak to my neighbours here in the centre of Buenos Aires. They'll tell me about how they lost all their savings, how they lost their homes. People are still fighting for things that they lost during that period. The thing is, here in Argentina, it's the striking difference at the moment. People really have little interest, know very little about what's happening because it's so technical. Economists are the only one that really understand what's happening. And because the effects of this are not going to have an immediate impact, and people are here in Argentina are already suffering with a raft of different difficulties because Argentina is already in recession, it has skyrocketing inflation. So it really hasn't filtered through to the normal man on the street, the impact of this. And from that point of view, people really haven't considered it in any way the same point of view as what happened in 2001.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us from Buenos Aires. Paul Byrne there, reporter with the Associated Press. Time for the business news with Emma McNamara, who joins us live from London.
Thanks, Claire, and I'm here at the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. Now, as you know, I've been here for the week. On Tuesday, we looked at the Irish in some of London's top jobs. Yesterday, we heard about the startups and cafe culture, London's shortage. And this morning, we're looking at housing. For years now, foreign trophy home buyers have been buying in central London from forcing Londoners further out. So much money is available for prime London space that most offers are too good to be turned down. And at the same time, house prices here rise, and there's also building building, and right now London is experiencing the fastest pace of new housing growth since just after the Blitz. Now, as some areas like Chelsea and Kensington become too expensive for the English, pretty rich, wealthy people to buy in, they're moving out further afield in London. And yesterday, Paul Cosgrove, who's a partner at estate agents Finlay Brewer, showed me around Brooks Green.
They're primarily English people coming from Kensington, Chelsea, who have had a flat or a small news house there and need more space. They're looking at good schools, good transport links, and as close to Kensington, Chelsea as they can be. Brook Green is an ideal choice for them, as is Brackenbury, which is the residential bit of Hammersmith, North Kensington, Queen's Park, Clapham to an extent. These are all areas that satisfy that need.
Why aren't they buying in Kensington and Chelsea anymore?
Because the price increases of property have been exponential in Kensington and Chelsea in the last 10 years. That has changed the profile of people living in Kensington and Chelsea to the extent that the community there is a very different community, if at all a community now.
What profession are these buyers around here, do you think, mostly?
Well, buying at 2 million plus, they're primarily city, bankers, finance.
And the type of house that you'd be expecting to get for your 2.5 million?
You'll get a good, solid, Victorian house, around 2,500 square feet, with, you know, usually good living space on the ground floor, and with 4/5 bedrooms, 2-3 bathrooms above, and a garden. Generally, they're around 30-35 foot, but that's, you know, plenty of room to have lunch, have drinks, and keep small children under control.
That was Paul Cosgrove, partner at Finlay Brewer in Brooks Green, and I'll be back at 10 to 8 with London's Mayor Boris Johnson and Simon Rubinson, who's economist here at the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. Claire.
All right, Emma, thank you. Let's find out what it says in this morning's papers now. Here's Deirdre Purcell.
The conflict in Gaza, specifically yesterday's shelling of a UN school within a refugee camp, where more than 3,000 people were sheltering, provides the lead this morning for the Irish Times. For his report from Jerusalem, Mark Weiss concentrates on the strong condemnation of the attack by Ban Ki-moon and by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency spokesman Chris Gunness, who has indicated that the agency's initial assessment is that the school was hit by Israeli artillery. Weiss also reports the statement from the head of the Israeli Southern Command, Major General Sami Turgeman, who said the military had destroyed 5 more cross-border tunnels between Gaza and Israel and were only days away from completing their objective of destroying them all. Inside the paper, John Reed, also writing from Jerusalem, reports that with 9 out of 10 Jewish Israelis united in backing the campaign against Hamas, minority groups in Israel, principally Arab activists and left-wing Jews, are complaining of increased harassment from law enforcement officials and Jewish Israelis. Some, he writes, have lost their jobs after being pictured and named on social websites, or have been arrested and charged after taking part in anti-war protests. The Irish Examiner leads with the announcement that starting from tomorrow, August the 1st, the number of penalty points received for the motoring offences of speeding and of holding a mobile phone while driving will increase from 2 to 3, and that from tomorrow on, novice drivers who've passed their tests will have to display an N plate for their first 2 years on the road. The Irish Independent goes with a statement from AIB's Chief Executive David Duffy, who presided over the announcement of the bank's results yesterday and gave a wide-ranging news conference in which he said that the property shortage will last for 4 more years and that the bank is in talks with 6 developers about providing finance to construct more than 5,000 new homes in the Greater Dublin area. In that context, the Irish Daily Mail leads with a story that more and more of what it calls the clipped wing generation are living at home because of the cost of renting and the unavailability of affordable homes. We're told that people forced to stay with their families now number up to 440,000 and can be aged up to 39. The Herald leads this morning with that discovery of a body with gunshot wounds in a County Meath field. The remains are said to be those of a man who, as you heard, had been reported missing by his family. Sources told the paper that Gordy were about to arrest this man in connection with a shooting last April, which, ironically, happened near where his body was found. All the other papers run their own versions of this story, and it provides the lead for the Irish Sun. The Independent carries the story that the Irish Brokers Association has called for cars of uninsured drivers, of whom there are an estimated 150,000, to be confiscated, as they are in the UK. And finally for now, the Irish Daily Star, the lead in the Irish Daily Star is based on yesterday's court case in which a man convicted of fraud was shown in court to have a wife, three children, two fiancés and another woman living with another of his children in Poland. According to Patrick O'Connell, the Star's chief reporter, one of the duped Irish fiancés is actually a Garda sergeant who, in an entirely unrelated case, given a high degree of publicity at the time, was given a suspended sentence for assaulting a man during an arrest with two other Gardaí 4 years ago. Her supposed fiancé supported her during her trial when she was entirely unaware of the other women and his fraudulent activities. On learning the truth, she immediately dropped him.
And to Scotland, where the economy is one of the key issues in the debate ahead of the Scottish independence referendum. Already, the Conservatives, Lib Dems and Labour have said that in the event of a yes for independence, Scotland wouldn't be allowed to remain linked to the pound. That's been dismissed by Alex Salmond as bluff, bluster and bullying. But it has ensured that it's become one of the most contentious issues of the debate, as RT's Fiona Mitchell reports.
We can choose to have the best things about having a strong Scottish voice and to keep the best things about being part of something bigger.
Let's vote to stay in the UK and let's choose the best of both worlds.
Well, I grew up in a Scotland where our wealth and natural resources are in Scotland's hands. Or will it be more of the same old, where our money is squandered by governments who are out of touch?
It's clear from the ads running across Scotland for the independence referendum that both sides recognised early on that one area is key, economics.
When asked in opinion polls, the economy just keeps coming through as the key issue. That
David Bell is a professor of economics at the University of Stirling. One of the areas of most concern is what currency Scotland would use, as the three main Westminster parties have ruled out an independent Scotland remaining linked to the pound.
If Westminster says it's not going to happen, then it's not going to happen. And they said the same about the euro. They don't want to run the risk of having to bail out Scotland in the event that the Scottish government got into fiscal problems, or if Scottish banks got into problems. And the Scottish banks, in relation to Scotland's size, are very big. They're bigger than the Irish banks were relative to the Irish economy, and that's a pretty sore point.
But with particularly high revenues from natural resources such as oil and gas, SNP leader Alex Salmond believes a deal on the currency issue could be done in the event of a yes vote.
But we should remember, and we should be clear, and we should understand that what is said by Westminster during the heat of a political campaign will differ greatly from the reality of life after the referendum. In the event of a yes vote, the campaigning will stop and the common sense agreements will start.
Author and commentator David Torrance says the currency debate shows the way in which this campaign has forced each side to justify their positions in a way they've never previously had to.
They'd sort of crept towards a position of retaining the pound a few years ago and no one had really noticed. And again, when people started saying, well, no, you can't necessarily do that, they were put onto the defensive and they had to justify their position, justify the detail of very complicated policy areas.
And that detail is important. As David Bell points out, people want more surety about what the future might hold.
What you get through in just in talking to people is this issue of uncertainty. And it's very true of the business community as well, particularly businesses that trade across the border. So economics is very important. And within the kind of economic arguments, this issue of uncertainty, not knowing exactly what would happen the day after a yes vote, is a really big determinant, I think, of how people are going to vote.
Amongst voters on the streets of Edinburgh, the views are mixed about the potential economic impact.
I don't want a yes vote, to be really honest with you, because I'm self-employed, eh? I work for myself. Ken, things are tough as it is just now. So even a year down the line, how can we predict how things go? What happens with our money? Can we be back in the sterling money, or is it going to be our own money? Have we got to go into euros? What?
I find it quite insulting that we're constantly told, you can't do this, you can't do that. I can't understand why anybody has their salary at the end of the month, they hand it over to a neighbour and then say, give me what pocket money you think I deserve. I don't think that's what we should have in Scotland. I think we should raise our own taxes, raise our own money and spend it as we think fit.
No doubt what way she'll be voting. That's Fiona Mitchell reporting there from Edinburgh.
Anyone interested in predicting what will happen at a senior level in the GAA in years hence will be interested to see what happened with Clare last
Indeed,
night.
Indeed, I was wondering where you're going with that. But they were fantastic. They're under 21 hurlers. They powered their way to a third Munster title in a row. They beat Cork easily, winning by 128 to 113. I was watching a superb performance from the Clare team. They dominated throughout. I thought the game was over as a contest at half-time when Clare led by 115 to 5 points. Now, afterwards, the captain, Tony Kelly, paid special tribute to joint managers Donal Maloney and Gerry O'Connor, who since 2010 have led this group to two successive minor titles followed by three successive under-21 titles. But despite that 13-point lead at the break, Donal Maloney didn't accept they had the game won at half-time.
Look, it's never over. I mean, you're playing Cork in the Munster final. You know, it's never over. It was a position we probably didn't expect to find ourselves in. Like normally, we go in at half time, we're either behind or maybe a couple of points up. We didn't expect to be in that position. But fairness to Cork, I have to give them credit. They came out and they fought, and they fought hard. And another team could have folded up, but it didn't. They kept going and going, and you know, full credit to them in terms of how they fought through the second half.
In soccer news, Celtic are facing the prospect of missing out on the financially lucrative qualifying for the Champions League group stages after a heavy defeat in Poland. Despite Callum McGregor giving Celtic an early lead, they lost 4-1 to Legia Warsaw, and in truth it could have been much more. Legia missed two penalties. Celtic played the entire second half with 10 men after Effie Ambrose was sent off just before the break. In other Champions League qualifiers, Zenit St. Petersburg slumped to a 1-0 defeat against Limassol in Cyprus, and Azerbaijan's Qarabag pulled off an even bigger upset. They beat Salzburg 2-1 despite finishing with only 9 men. Everton have signed striker Romelu Lukaku from Chelsea for a club record £28 million sterling. In the big overnight friendly game in New York, Liverpool beat Manchester City on penalties after a 2-2 draw. Stefan Jovetic put City in the lead twice. Liverpool hit back through Jordan Henderson and Raheem Sterling. Day 3 of the Galway Festival produced a first ever win in the Galway Plate for popular trainer Noel Mead, and the biggest career victory to date for young jockey Shane Shortall. Shortall rode 14-1 chance Road to Riches to victory in the feature, making it a double because earlier he'd won on Greatness, but his start to finish win in the big race saw Road to Riches live up to his name.
He was brilliant. There was nothing coming. There was no one to edge him on up that big stiff hill, and he galloped the whole way to the line for me.
But I mean, this is the most monumental moment in your career.
Absolutely. You know, I've been riding. It came there 2 weeks ago. I rode a 18,000 euro handicap winner, and it was absolutely brilliant. But this is just the stuff of dreams. I wasn't getting out of bed this morning expecting to ride a double. It might never happen again. I might as well make the most of it.
Yeah, well done to him. The feature today, the Galway Hurdle. The meeting begins at 1:50. Across channel, the Goodwood Festival continues. Michael Owen's Brown Panther seeking another win in the Goodwood Cup. Northern Ireland's Hall of Boxing medals at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow reached a record 9 after 6 more wins yesterday. And in golf, the run of big summer tournaments continues with the WGC Firestone International getting underway today in Ohio.
This weekend, the Polish community here will mark the 70th anniversary of one of the Second World War's most important and devastating events, the Warsaw Uprising. 250,000 people died when the citizens of Warsaw rose up against German occupation. Two Irish people who took part in the uprising will be remembered at a special exhibition in Dublin, which will be open to the public, as Morning Ireland's Justin McCarthy has been finding out.
This is the national programme from London. These are today's main events. Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns.
1939 and the beginning of World War II. Within a month, Poland had been occupied by the Nazis.
The atrocities committed by Hitler upon the Poles, the ravaging of their country, the scattering of their homes, the affronts to their religion.
British Prime Minister Winston Churchill spelled out the horrors visited on the Polish people. 5 years later, in August 1944, the people of Warsaw, armed with a few guns and Molotov cocktails, rose up against German occupation of their city. Their rebellion was timed with the arrival of the Soviet Union's Red Army on the outskirts of Warsaw. The Poles thought the Soviets would come to their assistance.
The Warsaw Uprising of August and September through to early October 1944 was one of the major insurrections, urban uprisings in European history.
Gabriel Doherty is from the School of History in UCC.
The intention was to forestall a potential communist takeover of Poland, but because the rising was defeated, that those domestic forces were essentially exhausted and paradoxically assisted the Soviet takeover of Poland, and therefore, again paradoxically, helped to ensure communist domination of Poland for several decades thereafter.
Like the 1916 rising in Ireland, the Warsaw Uprising inspired songs and stories in Poland. But there are other connections too. Two Irish people played a role in the Warsaw Uprising. They were Eileen Frances Short Galinska, born to Irish parents in Liverpool. She was a nurse and teacher. And Kenneth Ashmore, an RAF volunteer from Dublin.
His crew was on the way to Warsaw to provide them with so much needed anti-tank weapons, some food supplies, you know, basic stuff that was needed. Unfortunately, they were shut down by the Germans about 200 kilometers away from Warsaw. They never made it to their targets, but the plane crashed. All of the crew died. By the local people actually went over there. They dug out the bodies, they buried them, like they gave them a proper burial.
This weekend, members of the Polish community in Ireland are holding a special commemoration to mark the anniversary of the Warsaw Uprising. The two known Irish participants will be remembered at a special exhibition at St. Audien's Church in Dublin. Andrew Trala is the organizer.
We want to start to present our history and our traditions to the Irish people, because all of us have Irish friends and we're here long enough that we know so much about the Irish culture and about history, at least me, that we decided we need to give something back to the society.
The commemoration will feature an exhibition, a military reenactment, a film and lecture given by Dr. Gabriel Doherty on the comparisons with Ireland's 1916 rising.
Both were nationalist uprisings which took place in European capital cities, but there were many differences also, certainly in terms of scale, the sheer monumental scale of the deaths in the Warsaw Uprising and the destruction of virtually the entire city.
A quarter of a million people died in the Warsaw Uprising. They hoped Russia would come to their aid to fight a common enemy, but they were wrong. The large Polish community in Ireland, many of whom will participate in the 1916 commemorations here, say they also want Irish people to share a little of their history. Poland's outgoing ambassador to Ireland is Marcin Nawrot.
If you wish to be a part of the society, you have to show your history, who you are. And because the Warsaw Uprising was so important in our history, showing and sharing this history with you, that means Irish people here, is some kind of evidence that we try to show who we are and what value are important for us. If we are talking about some kind of similarities, I think that they are based on the value, not on the history. History was different, but still the attitude, the value which we were devoted to are the same.
Justin McCarthy reporting there on that exhibition on the Warsaw Uprising will be open at St. Audien's Church on High Street in Dublin tomorrow at 7 p.m. and it can be viewed by members of the public from Saturday at midday as well.
Later today, President Michael D. Higgins and the Duke of Kent will formally unveil a monumental cross of sacrifice at Glasnevin Cemetery to commemorate the many thousands of soldiers from Ireland who died in the First and Second World Wars. It's being unveiled today to coincide with the outbreak outbreak of hostilities of World War One. We'll be discussing that a little bit later on. But John Green is chairman of the Glasnevin Trust and is here now to tell us about this event today. You're very welcome, John.
Thank you.
What is a cross of sacrifice?
A cross of sacrifice is a symbol of the majority faith of those who died in both the world wars. There are crosses of sacrifice throughout the world. Everywhere that somebody who died a Commonwealth war grave is, there's a cross, can be a cross of sacrifice. In this part of the country, this will be the first cross of sacrifice.
And the provenance of this one then?
Well, this is because there are 208 Commonwealth war grave dead in Glasnevin. And the reason that we have been chosen first is because over the last 7 years, we have had a series of marking the graves of previously unmarked individuals in the cemetery.
But the provenance of the cross itself?
The provenance of the cross...
Where did it come from,
It's from County Laois, Stradbratty, McKeown stone. It's a blue limestone, and it has been hewn out of the rock down there and then put together, erected by our heritage team under the direction of the Office of Public Works.
Mm-hmm. Now, the significance then, tell us about that of today's date.
Well, when we were chosen to be the place for the first cross of sacrifice, we amalgamated that with a ceremony to commemorate the start of the First World War. There are a number of commemorations taking place this weekend, and this will be part of the commemoration for the whole island. We have emphasised in this not only the shared history on this island, and there'll be representatives from Belfast, but the shared history of these islands. So we have representatives from London, Scotland, Wales, the Isle of Man, Jersey and Guernsey.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that many thousands of Irish soldiers fought and died in these wars. What are they? Remind us of the numbers.
40,000 plus, 42, there's quite a debate going on, but it's at least 42,000 died in the First World War and 10,000 out of 100,000 volunteers in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a mixed view, or there certainly has been a mixed view of Ireland's involvement in the Great War and World War II. Do you think that mixed view is changing with the passage of time?
I think we've come to accept. It's only now that we're realising how many people, 1 in 6, volunteered to fight in the First World War. And I also think that there were very many different reasons why people went to fight in the First World War. We're particularly remembering the words of Willie Redmond, where he spoke to his great friend Arthur Conan Doyle about the need to build up a bridge over the graves of those who fought together. And then later on, a letter to John Horgan, he spoke about how his men were getting on famously with the Ulster men, and would to God we could bring this spirit back to Ireland.
Mm-hmm. So let's come back to today then. Tell us what will happen and who will be there.
Well, the President and the Duke of Kent will be the key people, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, the Minister of Arts, Heritage and Culture. There will be members of the Diplomatic Corps representing most of the participating nations, and there will be some of the relatives of the people who are buried there, and a wide circle of political and local people.
And the Duke of Kent is president of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and that's an organisation that you and the Glasnevin Trust have been working very closely with, isn't it, in the lead up to today?
We've had a relationship with the Commonwealth War Graves for over 80 years. The difficulties of memorialisation in the 30s are absolutely, it's a microcosm of that, of how we remembered our own Civil War dead and how we remembered the war dead. And in the last 7 years, we've built up a very close relationship with them. And we are very grateful to them for choosing this, which is not only a gift to the people of Glasnevin, but it's a gift to the nation, insofar as this is somewhere that we can all remember those, all the people who participated and died in the World Wars.
Well, John, thank you very much for telling us about it this morning. John Green there from the Glasnevin Trust. And live coverage of that event will be broadcast in a special programme on RTE One Television and RTE News Now from 1:20 this afternoon.
Now let's go to London. Emma McNamara has business news. And Emma, you've been looking at the property scene there.
Yes, Fran, and this morning we're looking at the housing market specifically in London and how a massive bubble in prices has seen Londoners pushed farther away from the places they grew up in. Earlier we heard how people who a few years ago would have bought houses in Kensington and Chelsea are moving slightly further out to places like Brook Green and Hammersmith, and others are buying even further away. Yesterday, London's Mayor Boris Johnson announced plans for London's Far East. It's a brownfield site beyond West and East Ham with 700 houses already built and permission for for over 10,000 more. The site at Barking Riverside has been in limbo since the early 90s, but building is now underway. Most importantly, land is being cleared for a new railway station there, but that station's funding isn't yet certain, nor is funding for other services like long-promised playgrounds and sports fields. Now, on his trip and his walk around, Boris Johnson, London's mayor, met Shelley Taylor-Morgan. She and her husband and two children have lived there for 12 years, and they're waiting for things like trains and soccer pitches. And Shelley spotted her opportunity to push for other services, and she spoke to Boris Johnson there yesterday. But first, let's hear from Boris Johnson himself. You were talking about Shelley having bumped into her just outside. Shelley says it takes her 15 minutes to walk to the shop for a pint of milk.
That's, and she's completely right. You know, I'm surprised it's as she's as quick as that, because I went past the shops and they're some way away. I think the answer is all that is going to change when the transport links come in. Everything I've seen in the last 6 or 7 years or whatever I've been doing this job, transport infrastructure makes all the difference to the prospects of a community. In the end, you know, we're seeing amazing growth in London. We're seeing huge numbers of people who want to live here. The population is about to exceed 8.6 million for the first time in history. London's going to be as big as it's ever been, bigger than it was in 1939. But the growth on its own is not enough. You can't just, it's not just about having more homes and more jobs. It's about the quality of people's lives. It's about what it's, what the community is like, what it's like to live there. So what Shelley needs is shops, and she needs, she wants play active sports activities, all that kind of stuff. And that will come with greater levels of economic activity in the area. You see it all across the city.
You mentioned the growth in the population. Another several million are planning on coming here. And in a way, that's great for the vibrancy of London and new businesses starting up and things like that. And it could be said to be problems in the Eurozone have had a good effect on London. Where are they all going to live? They can't all live this far out.
But we're not far out. You know, you could see the city. You could see it was just that. Once the station comes in, you'll be 20 minutes away from the city of London.
How long did it take you to cycle here today?
Fantastic place to. I could cycle here very quick. Actually, it wouldn't take me that long to cycle here. As it happened, I came by multimodal transport because I needed to experience the bus route to Barking. But you saw it. You could see the Gherkin just over there. And you could see the Olympic Park. You could see the Arsenal Middle Orbit. So it's not that far. It's the transport links that need to come in.
Londoners are buying houses like this, which you say aren't that far away. Meanwhile, the prime spots.
This is going to be, I promise you, in 50 or 100 years' time, this will be the heart of London. There'll be huge numbers of people living here. The whole thing will have been transformed. This will be Piccadilly Circus we're looking at.
Bits of Piccadilly Circus are falling down. I passed by there today.
You're joking. Well, I'm very surprised to hear that. We will look into it. I was there yesterday morning or 2 days ago. It looked in great shape to me, but obviously, sorry if it's falling down.
Is there a sense that some very wealthy foreign individuals are buying up lots of London property and sitting on them, not using them, keeping them as an asset, and that parts of really nice parts of London aren't going to be used anymore?
That has long been a problem. We've no reason to think that that's worse now than it's been, you know, historically. There are always people from overseas, including Irish people, by the way, who buy homes in London. And that's great, provided they live in them, provided they use them. And we want to see that. And one of the things I've said is that councils should use their powers to put a punitive council tax on homes that are unoccupied. And some of them are doing that.
How do you measure that, though?
Now, you've got to be very careful, because many of those dwellings are not, in fact, homes of rich people at all. So there'll be other reasons why they're whacking that surplus council tax on. So you've got to be a little bit careful about how you use that weapon, that tool, that utensil of discipline, because it can hit poorer folk as well.
Boris Johnson there, and I'm joined now by Simon Rubinson, who's economist at the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. Simon, people are getting pushed out of central London. It's very easy to assume that it's because of very wealthy foreign buyers, but what else is behind it?
Well, I think fundamentally the issue is that population growth is continuing to pick up, and particularly in London we're seeing more and more new households being formed, more people are living here, and unfortunately, partly because of the global financial crisis, supply really isn't just keeping pace. That supply of housing isn't keeping pace with the number of people who want to live in London.
There's a school of thought that the global financial crisis and youth unemployment in places like Spain and Portugal is sending lots of young people over here, and there's really nowhere for them to live, so it's affecting the high end and the middle and the low end, probably rentals as well.
Well, I think it's across the board. There's no doubt about it. With every form of tenure you look at, whether it's own occupation, whether it is private rent or social rent, there isn't enough housing in London.
We heard Boris Johnson saying that the foreign people coming and buying prime, lovely parts of London and maybe just using them as an asset, not so much as a home, isn't really a new thing. But also this kind of thing isn't just a bad thing. It has an upside, you say.
Well, I think that, you know, certainly encouraging people to come and sort of invest in Britain is clearly good, and showing that Britain's open for business is good. The other side of it is that a lot of these people who are investing in residential real estate in London are helping to fund housing development. A lot of developers have struggled with finance in recent years and needed to be able to make some pre-sales to get the funding for the wider development. So there is certainly another side to the argument that foreign investment is necessarily bad for London.
Where to from here? How is it going to balance itself out?
Well, I think there is a lot of pressure now to look at a lot of brownfield sites and really, and whether it's Barking, Riverside or many others around London, and really get some development going over the next few years. I mean, clearly the current government is focusing on that, but we know that Labour set up a Lions Commission as well to look at how they can get housing supply going. So I think both political parties are much more focused on trying to get housing delivery.
And briefly, London has very defined boundaries. How far beyond places like Barking, Riverside can London go, can building go?
Well, I think that absolutely. I think the commuter belt is going to extend, and I think the change in pricing and the strains in affordability mean that London will spread out beyond the traditional boundaries that we've grown accustomed to.
Simon Robinson, economist here at the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors in London. Thanks very much for joining me this morning. And that's it from London. Fran.
It's just coming up now to 3 minutes to eight, and we join Owen Sherlock at Met Erin.
Thank you, Claire, and hello from Met Erin. Well, it's cloudy at first today with some scattered outbreaks of rain and drizzle. The shower rain will become occasionally heavy later this morning and early this afternoon with the risk of some thunder. Drier and brighter weather will develop in the Westlow later in the afternoon, and this will extend to all parts later. A mild day with highs of 18 to 22 degrees in moderate westerly winds. There'll be a few isolated showers at first tonight, but more showery rain will move into southern areas later. Temperatures will fall from 11 to 14 degrees in light breezes. And there's going to be further spells of rain on Friday morning, but it's going to turn more showery in nature during the afternoon, with the risk of thunder once again. It will, though, become drier towards the evening. A fresher day tomorrow with highs of only 15 to 18 degrees in light winds. The showers are going to largely die out on Friday night, but some may linger along the east coast. A cool night in the west of the country with lows of 7 to 9 degrees. However, clouds in the east will keep it slightly milder there. And now the outlook for the next few days. A dry, bright start to Saturday for many parts of the country, but showers will return later in the morning and during the afternoon. Once again, they're going to be heavy and thundery, especially in the east of the country, but will die away once again towards the evening. A mild day with highs of 17 to 19 degrees and light northwest winds. And it's going to be dry and cool overnight on Saturday with lows of 8 to 11. Rain will affect parts of Connacht and Ulster on Sunday, with some heavy falls possible. It's going to be drier and brighter elsewhere, highs of only 16 to 19 degrees in moderate breezes. Bank holiday Monday will start dry in many areas, and apart from a little drizzle, it should stay dry. It's going to be a mild day with highs of 18 to 21 degrees in a moderate southerly wind. So a quick recap for today. Cloudy at first with patchy rain and drizzle. Showers will develop though later this morning and this afternoon. They will be heavy and occasionally thundery. Drier and brighter weather will spread from the west later today, and we can expect highs of 18 to 22 degrees. And that's the forecast. A very good morning.